Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Dan, our guest today is David Womack. He's president and CEO of Practice Management Institute. It helps American physicians deal with the challenge of rapidly training and certifying their non-clinical staff. And boy, that is a problem for many small businesses, not just in the healthcare field. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about your company, your website, and what you do and how you do it.
Oh, goodness. Well, our company, like you said, is Practice Management Institute. At our simplest definition, we're a training company. We teach individuals how to run a physician's practice, specifically in an outpatient setting, meaning a private practice setting. We do that through a series of both live classes and over the last 10 to 15 years have developed quite an online presence through our website. But probably everyone has experienced going to the doctor or being within the healthcare system at one point, and the people that you interact with and that deal with the billing and the coding and the customer service, that's the people that we train and try to teach them how to run a better, more profitable, more compliant practice.
Well, I'm a little older than many people, and I'm dealing with several different physicians, and the differences between the various groups is unbelievable. My diabetes or general health doctor, his staff goes 110%, but for another doctor who I won't mention by name, his staff is less than helpful. So
it's less than helpful.
It is really interesting to watch it, but I guess what makes a physician's staff good or bad in your opinion, and how do you train it? Because it also, I think, affects small business.
Well, how do you train them? You know, unfortunately, there's not a lot of formal education out there for running a doctor's office. A lot of it is kind of trial by error, or somebody got hired at a young age, or at a front desk position, and then they literally kind of grow up within the practice, and a lot of it is on the job training. What we've done for, gosh, going on 35 years now, is put together a pretty formal curriculum of education to take people from any perspective within the practice and try to hone those skills. A lot of role playing, but also following a lot of the rules and regulations. Healthcare is one of the most regulated industries that we've got today, and there's a lot of rules and regulations for how you do virtually everything. I think, first of all, probably from leadership on down. You talk about one of your practices that you go to, they're at 110%. I'm assuming that from the top to the bottom, there's probably a mission to provide great customer service. So it starts certainly with a desire to be able to provide great customer service, and then you've got to implement a plan to make that happen, front office to back office and top to bottom.
Very, very definitely. I'm going to let Dan take the next series of questions.
Sure.
Well, good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Dan.
Let me give you a firsthand
I'm having trouble hearing Dan.
I'm having trouble too, Dan. Dan, we're having trouble hearing you.
Can you hear me now?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. So there might be a little bit of a delay through the network. Anyway, let me go back to my question. I had an experience of...
And as soon as you start asking your question, that's where it goes haywire.
So,
Dan, there's a gremlin in the system that doesn't want you to ask questions.
Yeah.
let me use my cell and call into the program. Okay?
Okay.
Just give me a minute.
Sure.
While you're doing that, David, I'll go. You know, you hit it smack on the head when you said about from the top. Because, for instance, my regular doctor, it's a third generation doctor, a father to son to son. And
right.
They have been there and rendering services now for, I think it's like 57 years, in the same location on Fifth Avenue. And
wow.
Yes, it's very interesting, and I swear by him. But now, and you're absolutely right, it is the most regulated industry in the world. I don't know about the world, but well, here's Dan back. Dan,
so
are you
hear
back?
Me now?
Now
yeah,
we can.
Can you hear me? Okay. All right. That's fine.
Okay,
sorry about
Dan,
that.
Okay, it's all yours.
Okay, so we're starting over. Anyway, welcome to the show. And I was listening to your discussion with Don and wanted to share with you a really, from a personal standpoint, a very discouraging contact with my doctor. We lived up in New Jersey for 37 years. We moved down here to Florida. And we travel back and forth. And we have a doctor that we work with. I should say used to work with in New York. And I had a prescription. I had a thyroidectomy, so I have no thyroid gland. And I had a prescription for thyroid that was running out. And when I took it into the CVS pharmacy, they said they had no refills. They called the doctor's office and said he wasn't going to refill the prescription. And I called him, and he said, well, you're not with us very much anymore, so I don't know whether I should renew the prescription. And I said, doctor, I don't have a thyroid. I need a thyroid to survive.
Right.
But he still didn't send in the prescription. So I'm scrambling to find a doctor. I did find one here in Southwest Florida. But, you know, we're not talking about a cold. We're talking about medication that I need to live.
Right.
And anyway, so I agree with Don. I think there are a lot of things that you probably do in your practice that are easily transferable to other businesses. I want to know how long you've been doing it and how broad is your reach. Is it regional or do you do business nationally?
No, we do business nationwide. We've been in business now for, gosh, I think we're celebrating 34. I think next year will be 35. We've been doing training on a national basis, really, for that entire time. The company started originally out of Atlanta, opened up a second location, San Antonio, Texas, in the early 90s, and pretty much consolidated here in San Antonio in the early 90s. Still with a nationwide focus. There were just two different production facilities that came together as one. It was much easier to operate that way. We've even done a couple of programs in Alaska and Hawaii. So with the exception of a couple of the continental United States, we've pretty much done training in every state.
So this is not to be a difficult question or an embarrassing question, But you know, the old story about the cobbler's children didn't have any shoes. How much do you use training in your practice?
That's a great question. It's a great question. Probably not enough. We encounter things on a daily and weekly basis around here and have a lot of standing meetings where we kind of laugh at ourselves and realize that, you know, training is something that we need, and being a training organization, sometimes it's at the bottom of our list. I think every organization probably lacks in training, even the organization that Don was talking about that he's so pleased with. They probably find some gaps in their own knowledge and their own internal operations and things that they need to do better.
So when you have your stand around meeting and you realize that you've institutionally made a mistake, how do you correct it as part of your training program?
With the different standing meetings that we have on a weekly basis, we virtually touch 100% of our employees on a weekly basis. Some of those employees are in meetings, different types of production functions, in daily meetings. And it's just something that you start to tweak an agenda or tweak a task list of something that needs to be refreshed or redone. Probably like a lot of different meetings or a lot of different companies, there's a production aspect to our business. There's a sales aspect to our business. There's a customer service aspect, certainly financial. And in today's world, there's a technical aspect. And we pretty much, at least on an every other week basis, cycle through all of those different functions of our business and have an agenda that we can tweak at a moment's notice and try to make improvements where we've made a mistake.
You know, I've been in the consulting business for 40 years in addition to managing money for 43 years. And the reason why I asked you the question of how you memorialize it in working with some companies, it's amazing. If you've been in this business for a while, you can sometimes almost see the mistake coming.
You're correct.
You've got a new generation of people that don't have as much experience. And so what I always found difficult for corporations to do is to take the experience where they made a mistake and learn something from it and then memorialize it as part of the ongoing training program for the next group of hirees.
Right.
There seems to be a great deal of reluctance to not want to change the training program, even though by practical experience you know there's a deficiency there.
Well, I think part of our mantra around here is we try to break the model of, well, that's because this is the way we've always done it. We challenge that. We challenge those words almost on a daily basis. And probably like a lot of other businesses, we're in the process right now of moving our technologies from one kind of platform to another. And when you start looking at, you know, things like that and implementing any kind of different system that runs your business, you're constantly challenging, well, why exactly do we do this?
Mm-hmm.
And we make a lot of we talk about customer service and we talk about some of your all's experiences. We try to put the customer hat on as often as we can, because a lot of times we make changes around here for operational efficiency, and the customer sometimes is the last person we think about. So we've made this internal change for operational efficiency, and we realize at the end of the day, well, we really did a disservice to our customer. Yeah, it was easier on us to produce or easier on us to satisfy, but at the end of the day, it was a less than optimal experience for our customer. And you know, there's a lot of those processes we've had to redo and go back and do the old way because it was really a better experience for our customer.
Right. No, I've been involved both in retail and institutional, and I've always told people in retail, there are two things that are extremely important to the success of, especially if you're a point of sale or point of service contact with your client, like a doctor's office. The two most important things that you can do if you're interacting with people: teach your people to smile and teach your people to say thank you to the customer.
Absolutely.
Both are really very hard to get ingrained into a system.
Completely underutilized.
We had our number one
class for a number of years was literally how to be the best receptionist. And it was simply a front desk customer service training experience for the people that were just on the other side of the glass when a patient walked in the office. And as part of our training, we would encourage people to put a mirror right under the counter so they could see themselves. And smiling and having a warm presence was one of the number one thing that we would tell people to do. And you would hear from people after the fact, or you'd hear from people years later at a different conference, and they said, oh, my gosh, I did. I put that mirror there, as silly as I thought it was. I started to look at myself before somebody came to that window and realized, you know, what I was presenting. And it's an epiphany for a lot of people.
Well, I agree.
Can I jump in? Dan, can I jump in here and point out and ask a question? Why is there a window? Why is there not an open area? To me, that window represents a barrier. And,
absolutely. It's a bone of contention for a lot of different consultants. I think everybody that was designing medical practices back in the, you know, whatever, all of the practices that got designed around a certain time all look like that. Somebody took that playbook and just replicated it for years and years and years. That sliding glass, that opaque view where you couldn't see on the other side, it's like don't pay any attention to the man behind the curtain. I think a lot more of your modern practices have gotten away from that, but that's still a holdover for sure.
It's amazing. Interesting enough for me that the what I consider the poor interacting offices have those things, and the better offices don't. I just wonder if there's a correlation.
There's certainly a correlation, but it's also one of those things where I've seen it work both ways. I've seen an open environment that almost gives the feel of having that glass up, and I've seen places with glass that are very warm and opening, and they do things right. I think a lot of people did that for some kind of privacy and security, but there are certainly ways of handling privacy and security without the glass and without that broad line between the practice and the patient waiting area.
David, we have to stop a moment here for
sure.
One of our advertising, but we'll be right back with David Womack, President and CEO. Am I pronouncing it right, David?
It's Womack.
Womack. David Womack, President and CEO of Practice Management Institute. But first, a word from our sponsor.
At Valero, we believe life gets lived between every fill-up. So whether you go down the road on two wheels or four, whether your Wednesday night is spent racing to the grocery store or down a track, and whether you're dropping off the mail, the pizza, the kids, or all of the above, we're here to make sure you're never running on empty. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
We're here with David Womack. He's president of the Practice Management Institute. And Dan has another question for him.
Absolutely, I do. And I think it's one that I've been waiting to ask somebody in your position. Given the implementation of Obamacare in the term of President Obama, it seems to me that we have caused a huge disruption in the way offices have to process paper, file claims, reporting. Is that a myth or is that a reality?
Well, I think it's a reality, but I think it's certainly you can't lay it all at the feet of Obamacare. Things have been changing within healthcare for a long period of time towards some type of streamlining operational efficiency. I'll give you a quick example. I sat in a presentation years ago, and it was a futurist. He was a healthcare futurist, and he did He did an amazing presentation on the banking industry, and he basically took the audience through about 150 years of operational efficiencies in the U.S. banking industry. And he literally started out in the 1850s, and he started out with, you know, thousands of different types of currencies. And he started to go through these huge swaths of time to the modern day of having an ATM and a debit card and things like that. And that's a really, really quick example. But then he basically brought it back to healthcare. And this was in the mid-90s, late 90s. And he said, you know what, folks, we've only been on this path now for about 10 years. Here's what banking did in 150. So the move toward the electronic medical record and the move toward offices and hospitals and clinics and providers and everybody being able to communicate about a patient, that's where we're all headed. But trying to make that happen, we're all used to instant gratification. We're used to ordering something on Amazon and it be sitting in the parking lot by the time we either hang up the phone or hit send on our computer. Trying to move all the bits and pieces and the moving parts of healthcare and trying to work towards those operational efficiencies, that's years in the making. And to complicate it, you've got so many different players and so many different payment models and everybody trying to figure out, you know, what they're going to be happy with. It's the epitome of the moving the mountain.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was going back to my former doctor in New York City. My wife called him because she wanted to know when was the last time that I had a colonoscopy.
Uh-huh.
And the answer that she got back from the office, well, we don't see that on the file here. The archive is in a warehouse in Queens. So we physically have to go to the warehouse and look through all the documents to see if we could find an answer to that question.
Right.
When I would used to go in to see him after they did the blood draw and everything else, my folder, the current folder, had to be 3 inches thick, all paper.
Right.
And I, for one, don't understand why that isn't all digitized. Is there some prohibition, or is it a matter of expense, or why is it not digitized so that, because when I said to my wife, I'm going to have to find a doctor here in Florida, I wonder if we're going to be entitled to our records. And when she reminded me of the warehouse in Queens, who knows if I'll ever get the records. Why isn't this all done electronically?
Well, again, that's what we're on the move toward, but trying to lay down the law and enforce that to happen, wanting it to happen and forcing it to happen are two different things. And expense is the biggest part of that, Dan. That expense for, you know, a long period of time was on the individual practice to do that. There were a lot of practices that adopted this kind of stuff in the 90s. There's a lot of them that didn't. They didn't want to go through the expense. I got my feet wet in this industry back in the early 90s. I was selling paper. I was selling pegboard systems, and a lot of people won't know what that is, but a lot of people will remember, you know, years ago, getting a slip of paper that had a bunch of holes over on the left-hand side as part of their receipt. Well, I sold those office products to physicians, and in the early 90s, there literally were physicians that had switched back to paper, and there was a computer gathering dust back in a back storeroom somewhere. So people have made it. People were even making attempts to get more efficient back in the early 90s, but it just all the bits and pieces weren't in place to be able to do that.
So is in today's office, I suppose we could ask the question in a broader sense, regardless of what your business is, if you have to keep records on your clients, isn't the technology been, or hasn't the technology been delivered, developed enough that you don't need to have paper?
It certainly has. For a lot of small businesses, though, that's an expense and that they're just not willing to do. They may not see the economical advantage of doing it. You got a lot of our trainers are in front of audiences all the time, and I am assuming that our audience is probably reflective of, you know, business, small business in America. You've got a lot of people that are technically very advanced, take a lot of the specialties. Some of the bigger practices, they may have a little extra money. They may be a little bit more advanced. There are some small businesses that sell some high-end products that maybe have a little bit better cash flow and be a little bit more advanced. But if you take a small business that's struggling to make ends meet, you know, turning everything into digital may be one of the last things on their to-do list.
Yeah. Do you think that
Dan, can I just interrupt for one quick thing? My doctor does everything via computer, yet my file is still 3 or 4 inches deep with all kinds of printed
still
out
paper
material.
File. Right.
Yeah. It's interesting. I talked with someone at a conference on automating healthcare, and he said you're still not going to eliminate paper. And as they said 20 years ago, every office would eliminate paper, but we're still generating it at a record pace. But back to you, Dan.
Well, I was just curious because, you know, you have hospitals now that virtually do the nursing staff does all the reports. The doctors do the reports on iPads.
Right.
And it's sent electronically to the nurse's station, which then gets forwarded to whoever needs to get a copy of it. So the hospitals seem to have been able to, in many cases, digitize the records and eliminate the paper. And yet, small business. I understand what you're saying about cost, but if small business looked at a cost-benefit analysis, I mean, I've been in business 48 years. I would say the last 25 has all been digital.
Sure.
I can't imagine having 50 years of paperwork.
All right.
Where the hell I would put it. But just to move on here, I want to ask you another question, and that is, in your company's experience, is there a top 10 or a top 3 or top 5 that small businesses and medical practices, mistakes that they make that they can, if they focus on them and understand them, they'll have a much more effective and productive practice?
Yeah, Dan, I think we've talked a lot about customer service. I think customer service is certainly at the top of that list. I think also revenue cycle management, that's kind of the big buzzword right now and has been for some years. And simply put, any business needs to be looking at their revenue cycle. We all function certainly in a for-profit world. We all function by income and expense. In the medical practice specifically, third-party reimbursement is a for a lot of practices, is a significant part of their income, meaning somebody else, an insurance company out there, is supplying a lot of the income. And just trying to track that money and see how it flows through a practice in a small business, seeing how that money tracks and flows through their business. Typically, the gaps that you and I are talking about and where some of the mistakes are made and where some of the training needs to be, where the dollars seem to fall off, that's typically where there's a problem. So if you can follow the money through a practice or through a business, that's a pretty good indicator where there's some pain points.
So do you think that it's – what percentage of the doctors that you initially come in contact with see themselves actually running a small business?
Oh, you know what, Dan? I don't even know how to put a number on that anymore. You know, physicians go to school and are well-trained for a lot of years, get very little business training. I think modern day, a lot more physicians are going into a hired and employed position. You certainly still have those that are going out and starting practices. I think in the news cycle just a couple of weeks back, we had just passed over the threshold where more physicians were employed than independent. That's the first time that's happened, I think, ever.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's clear. Go ahead, John.
No. That's an interesting fact. No, I don't think it was generally known.
Right.
That. What is that? What do you think that tells you?
Well, the conversation from earlier about operational efficiencies and everything else. I mean, 20, 25 years ago, you had a lot of independent hospitals around the country. Modern day, you've got a lot of healthcare systems. Basically, hospitals have turned into systems. And as part of that system mentality, a lot of healthcare systems have developed clinic structures alongside that. And you'll hear the term every once in a while, you know, they want to take care of a patient cradle to grave. The way a lot of the payment models, capitation that was developed years ago, where they were paying, basically a set dollar amount to take care of a population of people. And we're certainly moving back towards something like that. And for that to happen, the healthcare system needs to be all-encompassing.
But there is, from the doctor's friends that I know, is that many doctors who were in, quote, private practice,
mm-hmm.
because, and this is what I've been told by the doctors, who have left their practices and in many cases sold their practices to that healthcare providing hospital that you talked about,
mm-hmm.
one of the reasons that they tell me that they've done that, why they've abandoned their private practice, is that they work better hours working on the staff of a hospital. They get a practice in their specialty if they have one, and they can make a predictable income, and they don't have to worry about running a practice.
Correct.
And then all of the regulation continues seems to be imposed upon them. They believe, and I'm not saying I don't agree with them, but by selling their practice to a healthcare system, they have a better job that pays a good living, that works reasonable hours, and gives them a very comfortable lifestyle.
That's certainly the attraction for a lot of them.
Yeah. And while there's some doctors that are coming out of medical school and want to set up their own practices, from what I'm hearing, there are a lot more doctors who have heard the reality of the medical practice world and have decided that the healthcare system is a more practical way for them to make a living and take care of their family than trying to build a private practice, or in other words, trying to build a small business.
Right.
They don't want to do that.
David and Dan, I hate to break this up because it's been a very interesting conversation, but we have to move on. David, your website again, your company and how people could reach you?
It's Practice Management Institute. Our website is PMIMD.com, like Practice Management Institute Medical Doctor, PMIMD.com. That's the easiest way to get a hold of us and find out what we've got available, and we're certainly there to help if we can do anything for people.
Well, David, I don't know about Dan, but I found this extremely illuminating this time around. What do you think, Dan?
Fantastic.
Yeah, no, I appreciate David's open response to our questions, and some of them might have put him a little bit on the spot, but that's okay. I'm sure he's used to that.
Absolutely.
But it was fascinating to listen to you talk about the passion you have for your business, which is important, and your desire to want to serve customers, and that's what we all want. So I thank you for your insight, and thank you for joining us today, David.
Fantastic. Thank you, guys.
Our next guest is Barbara Marder. She's Global Innovation Leader at Mercer, and we'll hear from her right after this commercial.
Life. It's made up of the simple day-to-day moments that keep us all running on full. Full
right,
of joy, passion, and restlessness. It's singing full on to your car radio with the windows wide open. It's a whole bunch of early morning rush hours and a few late night runs for Rocky Road. It's full of pit stops and drive-thrus. It's life, and we live it between fill-ups at Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
Our next guest is Barbara Martyr. She's Global Innovation Leader at Mercer, and she's here to discuss why small businesses need to concern themselves with human resources. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well,
Barbara.
Tell us...
This is Dan.
Well,
just going to say
go
hello,
ahead,
Barbara.
Dan.
I just want to say hello to Barbara and tell her.
Hi, Dan.
I'll talk to you in a few minutes.
Great.
Well, I was going to let you talk there. Barbara, tell us, you have a survey, you have some thoughts, and you have a new service. Tell us and a little bit about Mercer, which some of our audience may not be aware of.
Absolutely. Mercer is an HR consulting firm, and we help companies, mostly larger organizations, in the areas of health, wealth, and careers. So we work with companies around the world in those areas and impact over 100 million employees' lives every day. But what's interesting is that last year, Mercer launched Mercer People Pro, which is specifically designed for small businesses. And we actually have created a completely different business model to do that because the typical Mercer model and the fee structure and all of that is, very reasonable for mid to larger companies, but sometimes challenging for small businesses.
Well, having said that, why do small businesses need HR?
Well, it's a really interesting question because Mercer People Pro works with what we would call micro businesses, really, startups, a few people, all the way up through to, companies who are somewhere in the area of about 250 employees. And the way these companies grow, for the most part, is a lot of them are growing fast and adding groups of employees pretty quickly. And I think what's so interesting is that all of a sudden a business that started with a few people is now a business of 10 people, 20 people, 100 people. And not only are the legal requirements different as these businesses grow and thrive, but also just the policies and the culture need to come along with the business as well. What a CEO of a startup needs to do when there's five people working very closely with them is quite different than when there are 50 people or 100 people. And many of the small businesses will start off without a human resource person at all. One of the employees, whether it's the CEO or the founder, will play that role. With whatever support, but the needs get greater as companies grow, and we actually believe that setting a foundation for human resources and employee policies and things like that as companies continue to add new employees and they grow and some of the issues that they find themselves dealing with are much more complex. Had they laid the groundwork early, a lot of those issues could have been avoided in the first place. And I think you've even seen some very, very high-profile, large companies that have grown super fast, out of the Silicon Valley, for example, are now dealing with human resource issues that, had they had policies in place in the earlier days and the culture of the business had grown up with that in mind, those things probably could have been avoided.
Dan, I'm going to ask one more question and turn it over to you, if I may. But
sure.
I saw a study that less than 18% of small businesses even have written employment manuals, and that alone can cause problems. What do you say to that?
Absolutely, and the number, certainly the number doesn't surprise me, but thinking about the cost and the effort to put together an employee handbook that at least covers the nuts and bolts of what you'd want a policy to cover, the expense there is not significant, and you know, it's certainly something that Mercer PeoplePro can help companies with, and there are, you know, templates even to get started with. But just having something like that in place can prevent a whole myriad of issues that are going to come up down the road as the businesses get bigger. So it just feels short-sighted when, you know, even a very small business can have at least the minimal range of policies covered, and then at least they have something to come back to as, you know, the business gets more complex and new issues arise. So it seems like a very reasonable spend for a small business.
Dan, it's all yours.
Thank you. Well, just to follow up on that, I understand your perspective that it seems like a reasonable expense, but I wonder if a small business person, somebody who employs less than, you know, 5 or 10 people, which makes up a huge percentage of the small businesses in this country.
Right.
I wonder if the owners, I mean, once you hire somebody, your business changes. I at one time had a business where I had 3 or 4 people working for me. Out in the hinterlands, they weren't even in the same office with me. And now I'm down to me. So I wonder if part of the reason many, I won't say all, but a number of small businesses don't have an employee manual or don't have HR resources is because the owner doesn't believe it's necessary. I wonder if that's the biggest obstacle.
Yeah, no, I think what you describe is a huge obstacle, and you know, often with a business of that size, you know, you, the owner, have handpicked the people, and you feel confident in them and how they're going to approach work and how you're going to deal with things. So that all feels very comfortable, and there doesn't feel like a need for anything, you know, more heavy, more structure. But what I've always said as well, that, you know, if you're a small business that wants to work with, for example, larger companies, you know, larger companies do have sort of policies around the companies that they work with. And for example, if they're, let's say a larger company's data, confidential data, is going to be exposed to your employees, then should there be background checks done? You know, are they going to be comfortable with the people who are touching their information? So, again, I do think it, you know, what are the aspirations of the small business, and what will you need to have in place should the business thrive and be very successful? And I think in a lot of those cases, you know, even a small business could start very early with things that are going to be important to your clients.
Would you say that it's more likely that in the interview process, that a larger company interviewing a smaller company, and maybe I'm being oversimplistic here, but that the bigger company is going to want to see what, quote, systems the potential partner or supplier has. And just taking your example, how do you protect our information? is there a naivete on some businesses that don't check, or am I wrong there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that all companies have the same policies around companies that they're doing business with, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, certainly as I've responded to requests for proposals and requests for information and
mm-hmm.
just contracting in the normal course of business, and again, many of the larger companies that I'm sure a lot of the small businesses would like to work with, they're going to require certain things to happen as part of that relationship, especially if, you know, confidential data or, as you're saying, systems that integrate and could, you know, impact their operations. They're just going to have to be in place before the small business would be able to work with some of these companies. So I think from a business perspective, some of this is just good business. From the sort of employment relationship and the culture and, you know, how the workplace interacts with each other, you know, that's kind of a different way of looking at it. I think, truthfully, when you look at it from both sides, it just makes sense to get some of these things nailed down and policies around certain things earlier versus later.
Dan, let me interrupt our guest and you for just a moment. We have to take a break for one of our advertisers, but we'll be right back with Barbara Martyr from Mercer.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
We're back with Dan Perkins, my co-host, and Barbara Martyr. She's Global Innovation Leader at Mercer. And we're talking about her new offering, I guess you'd say it, for human resources. Dan, back to you.
Thank you, Don. Barbara, what does a global innovation leader do?
That's a great question, isn't it? Well, first of all, the role is new. I've just been appointed the Global Innovation Leader in the last few weeks. But I've actually been part of innovation at Mercer for the last few years. And so part of – basically my role is to oversee innovation that's happening across Mercer. And that innovation takes, you know, many different shapes and forms. And there's also many different – stages of innovation as well. So, for example, with Mercer PeoplePro, that was launched last year, and I'm now overseeing the kind of go-to-market and commercialization strategy for Mercer PeoplePro, while for other innovations, they may be actually back in the very early stages of ideation and product development. So it's really overseeing the innovation cycle from start to finish and across multiple things that we're innovating at the same time in all different parts of the world.
Barbara, under your PeoplePro, you said it's about a year old. Are there a lot of similar challenges that you're seeing that the people that are coming to you have? I'm not saying that it's routine, but sometimes there are just basic fundamental flaws that happen all the time and people just don't see them. So are you seeing anything in particular that seems to have boiled to the top as a problem that seems to be in this small business segment that you're working in?
There's definitely themes in terms of the kinds of projects that we've done over the past year. And we've done, you know, many. And again, I wouldn't necessarily say that they're related to flaws in the business, but I think a great example is A lot of the work we do is around pay benchmarking, and that could be both for employees, new hires, or executives. And one of the reasons that even these small businesses want the experience of Mercer is that often they're needing to bring that to their board or their advisors in terms of getting those pay packages or, incentives approved. And, again, that's where Mercer's experience and credibility working with, much larger organizations lends that credibility even to the small business who's looking to get this approved by the board. So a lot around compensation, pay benchmarking, compensation strategies, a lot around communications, communicating with employees, for example, a lot around policies and audits and things like that, training and coaching of executives. So definitely kind of a common theme around those kinds of things. Interestingly, I think from a health and wealth perspective, while we certainly can provide that kind of assistance, and we've definitely been asked to almost be an extension of an HR team for open enrollment, for example, we can do kind of this temporary placement. A lot of the times the small businesses are getting advice for health and wealth through their brokers or through providers. So in those areas, typically they'd be coming to Mercer People Pro for something that's out of scope for, the kind of advice that those brokers or providers can offer.
I need to ask Don, how much time do I have with Barbara?
You got five minutes, actually 7
okay.
minutes. Dan.
Okay, good. Good, we're going to have some more fun. Barbara, what I want to know now is how has the change in the direction of the economy affected your business? We know that in the first 7 months of this year, we've added 1 million new employees to the workforce. Plants are being opened and new jobs are going to be created and companies are expanding. They're even reopening old coal mines and drilling and digging for new coal mines, which was unheard of in this country. So there's a lot of changes that are going on. And what we heard for a number of years on our other show is that, and heard on this show, people in small business, that it was the 8 years of the Obama administration, and I'm not making a political statement here, I'm just talking about what they told us was demonstrated by the fact that the economy did not grow anywhere near its potential. So a lot of people who came on that were working in small business and had small businesses or supporting small businesses have told us that those were very difficult times, and as their business contracted, they had to lay off people. But now it seems that the economy has turned, and I'm wondering if you're seeing any turn in the economy in your business.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting question, and it definitely. So I think, from the perspective of, in terms of employment and being able to find easily the talent that you need, I would say that businesses, both small and large, are struggling and will struggle more as, unemployment rates get lower, and it's just the war for talent, as we've always called it, heats up then. So, then you've got, theoretically, again, you've got small businesses competing with large companies for talent, and, in some cases, the small business is exactly where, some of the freshest new talent wants to work. And, partly because of the unstructured way the businesses are and lots of flexibility and, things like that. So I think in some cases, the small business will still be very attractive to a lot of the folks who are looking for, you know, a more interesting and flexible working environment. But what those small businesses can offer in terms of, you know, benefits and perks and rewards and things will be challenging to compete with the larger companies. So I could definitely see that as a challenge. But I think one other interesting sort of phenomenon about what's happening with the way work is getting done is it actually really plays into the Mercer People Pro business model, because we're basically employing Mercer alumni, Mercer alumni of Mercer clients who, for whatever reason, want to work more flexibly. So they're willing to exchange, you know, pay and benefits and things like that for completely flexible work environment that allows them to work around their own schedules. So, you know, basically the People Pros are a completely flexible workforce that sets their own hours and when they want to work and how they want to work, but still allows small businesses to tap into their expertise. And, you know, the projections are that by 2020, 50% of the workforce will be flexible workers or part of the gig economy, whether that's, you know, full-time, part-time, side hustle kind of work. But I think it'll be really interesting to see how businesses respond to, you know, workers' desire for more flexibility and controlling when and how they work and where they work. I think that's going to be interesting for both small and larger businesses.
Barbara, we don't have much time left, but I want to follow up that your comment because
plenty
we've had several people. Okay, we've had several people on the show who've talked about people who thought they wanted to work at home, that they changed their mind because there's no social interaction with the employees in the office, and they felt after a while that they had become isolated from their employer. I'm not saying it's a huge situation, but enough that it's been raised a couple of times on the show that one of the challenges about remote working is the remoteness of working.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if that's a fad that's declining, or is it still strong, or what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting perspective, and I think you've even seen some high-profile companies calling back work-at-home and remote workers. So, you know, there are definitely pros and cons to from both sides, from the business side, from the worker side, in terms of flexibility and remote working and things like that. My personal perspective is that as more and more people are working from home, and as the technologies for video interfaces and things like that become more affordable and more mainstream, you know, the work-at-home people will more or less feel like they are connecting with their colleagues and their peers. They're able to see them, not just talk to them, and that even flexible, you know, flexible gig economy workers who maybe aren't even attached to a specific company will start to build communities around them where they get that interaction with peers, even though they're not even working for the same company. So I do think as more and more people are working remotely, are part of the gig economy, yes, I think they still will want that community around them. It's just going to be more interesting and innovative ways of how they make that happen.
I know that on my own personal experience, I'm a writer, and I one of the things that I do, I'm a writer, and I'm part of the gig economy because I have two agencies, lobbyist firms in Washington, D.C., that hire me to write a commentary on specific issues that their clients are concerned with. I don't think I've even talked to them on the phone. I get probably two to three assignments every couple of weeks, and I communicate with them by email. My editor, I communicate with them with email, I do occasionally talk to them on the phone. Never talk to the customer, and yet I conduct an ongoing business that allows me to write for somebody else, not as an employee but as a contractor, and it provides income for me and content that they're looking for and perspective. So that's probably the extreme of a remote person, but I'm very comfortable with that environment. If I had to be making decisions for a business and implementing it for a business remotely, might be a tough thing to do.
Barbara, you continue. Continue, Barbara.
I was just going to say, I mean, I don't know that every person is, you know, really well suited for the kind of remote working and environment that you were just suggesting, Dan. I do think mm-hmm. people need to understand themselves. And for example, if you're someone who has a terrible time filtering out distractions, you know, working at home with all the distractions of being at home or, you know, kids running in or whatever, I mean, you know, you need to understand yourself and see if you're the type of person that's likely to be successful that way. But I know I've spoken to many people who feel like they're way more productive working at home because they don't have the typical office distractions and they don't have to add the commute time. They can work during that commute time. So, I think you do mm-hmm. have to know yourself and see, you know, make sure you're introspective
right.
about if that's going to be well-suited.
Very good. John, Don?
Unfortunately, Barbara, we've run out of time. Barbara, tell people how they can reach you, your website, and your new offering.
Absolutely. So if you're interested in Mercer, which is Mercer.com, or specifically for the small business, MercerPeoplePro.com, please visit our website. We have blogs. And, you know, personally, if someone wanted to reach me, it's Barbara.Martyr@Mercer.com.
Thanks for the discussion. Barbara, will you spell out your name?
Sure. It's Barbara, and the last name is Martyr, Marder.
Thank you so much for being with us. I know I learned a lot. I think Dan as well. What do you think, Dan?
Well, Barbara, thank you for being such a good sport of putting up with me throwing crazy questions at you, but it was very informative. I enjoyed having you on, and thank you for being our guest.
Great. It was a pleasure. Thanks to both.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Dan, it's now time to hear your tip of the day.
Dan Perkins here for Recalculating.biz with your small business tip of the day. People are concerned about the massive hack to computer systems that took place in over 150 nations just a few weeks ago. Were you protected? So here's the tip of the day. Close the windows and doors in your computer. If the windows and doors are locked, the bad guys can't get in. And the best way to lock the windows and doors in your computer is to turn it off when you're done for the day. If you leave the computer on 24/7, bad guys can attack you when you are asleep or away. You lock the doors and windows of your home when you leave home, don't you? So lock the doors and windows of your computer. If you have employees, make sure they turn off their computers when they leave for the day. Make sure you set your computers to automatic download for system updates. That way you will always have the most recent operating system. Just turn off the computers and you'll have a new title, the head of cybersecurity for your business. Go to recalculating.biz for more helpful tips. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating Small Business Tip of the Day.
Before you hear this, or this, or even this, before you turn a key, step on the gas and let it rip, before you get up and out and on the road, you have to be fueled by something. Make sure that something is Valero. Valero top-tier certified quality fuel keeps your engine running cleaner, better, and longer. Find a station near you at ValeroCleanGas.com.
Well, Dan, what did you think of today's guests, and what are your final thoughts?
Both the guests were terrific. If you, our listeners, missed any part of today's show, or you want to go back and listen to some older shows, go to our website, recalculating.biz, and you can see the listen to the shows, past shows, and pick up on what you missed. I think we're on a roll here. We're doing really well.
I agree. So at this time, I'll just say goodbye.
Me too. See you next week.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.
We're getting ready for our next guest, Dan. I'm going to call her now.
Okay, I've got a 11:30 interview, so I've got it with CNN. I got to be off before 11:30.
What was your question, Meg?
So, are we redoing what we did last time, or you have a new?
This one is taped, Meg. This is a taped interview with Dan Perkins, my co-host on a different program.
Oh, okay. So we're kind of doing what we did before.
The questions are going to be the same, Meg. Just be
okay.
Yourself and guarantee you will come out a great interview. All right?
Okay. All right. All right. Sounds great.
And we're going to – Dan, you're on?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This is Meg Barnhart, and I'm going to start it in 5 seconds. Then our next guest is one of the more interesting people I've had the pleasure of talking with. Meg Barnhart has taken slow cooking to a new level with first a blog, then a food company, and then some other things. The name of her company, which I really love, is The Zen of Slow Cooking. Meg, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Meg, tell us what your product is and where people can get it and how you started.
How we started. Okay. So what we do is my partner, Jane Mackay, and I have created a line of premium spice blends crafted exclusively for recipes for the slow cooker. We have 10 different flavor profiles, and they're all globally inspired. We both love to travel, so using our mutual passion for exploring the world, we have blends ranging from our award-winning, Sophie award-winning Szechuan blend to a Moroccan tagine to coq au vin to a great American classic smoky barbecue. They're sold online. They're sold at Whole Foods store. We just signed with a new company in Northern California called Share Organics. So we're going to be bringing it all over the country. So it's really exciting. Also in Oregon at Marketed Choice. So we've got some places. And then we also have a line of meal kits that we launched with Peapod last summer. We have our third meal kit, which is a vegan, a vegetarian meal kit, just launched last week, which is already doing well here in Chicago. And then the genesis of the business really started with many, many years ago with my failed home cook story. I was struggling to get food on the table and called my best friend one night when my children were little, and I just said, I just can't get it done. I can't get food on the table. And she said, stop crying, get off the phone and go buy a crock pot. And that's really where my story began. I didn't understand what she meant. I had grown up in a home where we had just wonderful family dinners every night, and my mom cooked from scratch in the afternoons. And so I wasn't familiar with the crock pot. So I went out the next day and bought myself one and fell in love with it. It helped to recreate my childhood home. I would put my food into the slow cooker after the children went off to school in the morning, and then we came back to really delicious dinner in the evening. I moved us out of the kitchen into the dining room and tried to kind of recreate my my childhood memories. And anyway, that led to a food blog in 2012. And the genesis for the blog and the business really was my middle son was diagnosed as developmentally delayed when he was a baby and didn't have functional language until he was four. So school was really difficult for him. And I found there was so little consciously created employment for adults with any kind of learning challenge or disability that I wanted to create a business for him. So that's really what led to my partner Jane and I launching The Zen of Slow Cooking in 2012. And so in addition to creating spice blends, we also employ adults.
Meg, I'm going to interrupt you. You throw so many things at us. As usual, you throw so many things at us. Okay,
I know.
Dan,
yes.
Let's bring order out of this. Why don't you ask her some questions, get order out of this.
We'll see if we can get her to slow down a little bit so people can enjoy her very attractive voice and her charming personality. I'm a slow cooker, but I've been doing it probably longer than you are. and I love to make spaghetti sauce. With a big hunk of beef and tomatoes and onions and herbs, and turn it on in the morning and come home and have almost a bolognese sauce when I get done at the end of the day. So I enjoy that a lot. And roasting chickens and things. Is that a minority? And I mean by minority, a small part of the food market of slow cooking?
You know, that's such a great question. Actually, interestingly enough, 83% of all, well, depending on what you read, between 70 and 83% of all U.S. households own a slow cooker. So it's a very popular device, but only 40% people own it actually use it. And within that 40%...
That's just going to ask you how many actually use it.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then about 20% of that, they use it once a year, you know, for their favorite, as you said, you know, slow cooking recipe. But there is 20%, which equates to 21 million homes who use it at least once every other week. So it's a huge market and really an untapped market. When we first started the blog, and, you know, there were just so few really good slow cooking recipes, and that's really our niche, is using whole foods, our spices, and to create a really delicious flavor. So
that's true.
So it's a big market. Yeah.
So have you ever tried making soups in your slow cooker?
You know, I do. Soups are really popular with the slow cooker and also with a new device on the market, which is very popular, called the Instant Pot. And it's interesting. My partner, Jane Mackay, who's really the culinary expert in our business, when I first met her and she, I asked her if she'd help me get this business off the ground, this idea, literally it was an idea on a piece of paper, and to how to bring a little Zen into the kitchen of the home cook and also create the employment model for adults with disabilities. She's from the UK, didn't have a slow cooker, and she was already doing some recipe testing and whatnot. She was here in Chicago as an expat. And she went out the next day and bought herself a slow cooker, and she spent the whole weekend playing with it and developed a delicious bone broth, which is now very popular. So there's lots of utility for the slow cooker that can bring a lot of health into the home.
Right. So do you think that the popularity of the slow cooker is a function of people more concerned about what they're putting in their bodies today?
Yeah, I do. I think probably interestingly enough, the slow cooker was actually invented here in Chicago in 1940 by Irving Naxton, and it was called the Beanery, and it was really to help the Jewish housewife observe Sabbath. It's a wonderful story. It was inspired by his grandmother, and so it was really that's sort of really the genesis. And then it's was the patent was bought by Rival in 1970 and then came out as the crock pot in 1972. So I think in those days, it was very much as women were in the workforce, you know, trying to get people, trying to figure out the solution to, you know, to cooking, you know, that, you know, when you were away from the home. But I think it became associated with, I think, a poor quality meal. And, you know, I think today's generation of slow cookers are looking for something. They see that it's a great appliance, and if used properly, can really help create a from-scratch experience in a time-pressed, when you're in a time-pressed home. So I think that it's you know, health, if there's a delicious outcome to it. So I think it checks off a lot of boxes for today's home cook.
Well, I agree with you. I think the idea that you could in an era where we have two household incomes, you can use the crock pot to put together an all-encompassing meal before you leave for work in the morning, and it's ready to eat when you come home. So it's a really efficient use of your cooking time. Excuse me. And you can do a lot of different things. The one thing that I wanted to ask you in your analysis of, quote, slow cookers and utilization, there's another cooker, another slow cooker that isn't like a crock pot, but is used extensively, rice cookers, which are a form of literally cooking all day to infuse different flavors. Are rice cookers and alternative cookers in your crock pot slow cooking universe?
We don't. On our blog, we have a section devoted to choosing a slow cooker, and currently we don't review rice cookers, but the other one we really, really like is this new Instapot, which is a really high-speed electric pressure cooker. So you can do, for example, we had to do a big event in Chicago for Green City Market. We had to do samples for 75 people. And what would normally have taken us many hours to do if we slow-cooked it, we did the entire sampling in 24 minutes using the Instapot. So you can put everything in. It has a sauté function, and then you can switch it right to either a slow-cook function or a high-speed electric pressure cooker function. So it's a great, great device, and we highly recommend that. And going back to the thing about going back to the work question, one of the things that I think is that I love so much about slow cooking is that when you walk in after a long day at work to come back to a house that smells like someone's been cooking for you all day, really shifts the energy of your family. And I think that's one of the things that's missing in a lot of homes today, is that people don't cook and they don't experience that really wonderful sensorial feeling of, you know, smelling your food in your kitchen. So I think that that's something that we're also trying to help people also achieve.
But I would say to you, Meg, is I think where those sensations that you talked about after coming home after a day at work and having the slow cooker, I think when you've got companies like Brew Apron and the like, who are not necessarily preparing the meals but giving you everything that you need, so that you don't have to spend a lot of time shopping and you have the whole meal is presented to you that you can do in, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes. Also, perhaps a representation of that shared experience of the family cooking, which is a positive experience because you cook it and then you eat it. The slow cooker works for many, many different types of meals, but I find it fascinating that Blue Apron and now that Amazon has purchased Whole Foods and is already talking about a home delivery service, there are changes that are taking place in the whole cooking area, and the slow cooker and the quick cooker that you're talking about, and the meals, the ability to have home cooked meals, but the prep work is done by somebody else is interesting.
How much time do we have? I've actually, just so you know, we are actually in that meal kit space. That's probably going to be our biggest growth category. We've got two meal kits we've already launched with Peapod, and we just launched our third one last week. And would love to be in a place with Blue Apron with some of our premium, blends, because to us, we really just want to encourage people to slow cook once a week. That's sort of our dream, because you're really cooking in community. You're cooking batch cooking, whether it's a Sunday afternoon or a time-pressed Thursday. But to your point, what Blue Apron's doing with, hand-selecting everything, or HelloFresh, they're really approaching this whole market in a different way, which is exciting.
Mm-hmm. Good. Don, how are we doing on time?
Oh, we're doing fine, but I'd like to ask her a couple of questions about her business. If I understood my research correctly, your partner is moving back to London, and how are you going to handle your business with this change?
Well, she actually has already moved back, so we've been managing it, and we knew that she'd be moving back at some point. So we began maybe close to 2 years ago, working virtually and working to refine, our communication style. So from a technology perspective, we talk every day. So we have no issues with that. And then in terms of the appearances that we do, she'll be flying back into Chicago, and then we lump all of our, if there's any media things we have to do or cooking demos, we're kind of putting all those things together strategically so that people can see us. So it's fine. It's working. And then I'll be back in London or Bristol, where she's moving, in November, and we're going to do a slow cooking class there because we also hope to be launching our product overseas as well.
Well, let me ask you, you said earlier that you were hooking up with a California company, but you said it so fast, I didn't get all the details, and I'm sure our audience would like to know more about.
Well, we just got called by a great food brokerage in Northern California called Cher Organics. They are taking us on and building our business in Northern California, which is exciting. A few stores out there in Oregon. We're at Market of Choice, which is a great line of specialty food stores. So, we're just slowly but surely building the brand all over the United States. We're about to sign with Kehi, which is a international food distributor. So hopefully we'll be on a store shelf near you soon.
we have to start Meg, right here, and a moment for a commercial, but we'll be right back with Meg Barnhart, who's talking about the Zen of Slow Cooking. I just love that title. Hold on 1 minute.
Okay.
Don?
Yes.
Come to me off the air, please.
We're back here with Meg Barnhart. We're talking about the Zen of Slow Cooking. And for our last round of questions, we go to Dan.
Meg, I have one more question. Have you considered switching your blog to a full-blown website where you could do simple videos showing people how to prepare slow cooking?
Yes, actually, that's something that's on our to-do list for the fall. We have one video that we did for adults with disabilities on YouTube, and then we've got the blog, and then we're hoping to, and then we have the shopping site, but then also create some mini tutorials, which is so popular right now. So yes, it's on our to-do list.
Well, I want to thank you, Meg. I've got another commitment I've got to go to. Thank you for
thank you.
Bringing back my slow cooking experiences, and I'll get my cooker out and start doing it again. Thank you for
Wonderful.
Joining us on the show.
Wonderful.
And
okay.
I'll turn it back to Don.
Okay,
well,
great. Thank you.
Meg, your website again and how people can reach you?
It's www.thezenofslowcooking.com.
Now you start going slow. You talked so fast before.
I know. It's a challenge for me. Yes, thezenofslowcooking.com.
Okay. Meg, thank you so much for being with us today. And have a great day and a great career with a great
All right,
product.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Have a great day. Bye-bye.